I would like to follow up on our previous discussion of chapters 28 through 31, because our conversation brought out to me that as I changed the syllabus a little bit for this semester, I also changed the relation of our readings to your philosophy readings. That means that certain concepts you were intended to get in philosophy before we brought them up in theology, we ended up having to cover in theology last time. So I'm going to depart from my usual practice. Normally, I try to offer just a few primer notes, some basic ideas that will help you dig into the text, and then I leave you to discover the arguments and so on in the text on your own. Given that I have put you at a disadvantage vis-a-vis your philosophy class, this time I'm actually going to walk through the reading, through chapters 28 through 31 myself, somewhat carefully, and then invite you to raise questions when we meet in class. So I will begin at chapter 28 with paragraph 1. And this we talked about some in class, but I want to review. So we're talking about God's intellect, God's intelligence. Now in us, this is the power that we call either intellect or reason. As we've discussed last time, this is a power that's immaterial. It achieves its universality of knowledge by abstracting from matter. And the within us, we can distinguish a couple of moments in the knowing process. And someone in class last time captured this well by saying that it seems as though understanding is the result of reasoning. The relationship between understanding and reasoning is that understanding is the resting point, the place you come to. And that's getting at this basic difference in our experience. We are aware of a kind of movement in our thought process, whereby we go from premise to premise to premise, from consideration to consideration. We bring up one idea and then another idea. So there is something about our intellectual knowing that is kind of like running. But if we look at each step individually, or if we look at the end of the process, we find that there's also within us a simple gaze of the mind. If I talk about, you know, man is a rational animal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is a rational animal, and so on. When I think of man, just the term man, right at that point, I'm just looking at the idea. I'm not running around and doing a discursive process. And similarly, when I make an argument that may go through, you know, many syllogisms strung end to end, and then finally reach a conclusion, at the end, I'm just looking at my conclusion. And that's just simple gaze tends to be referred to not as reason, but as intellect. Right? Reason is a word that's more often associated with the movement of the mind, whereas intellect is the word more often associated with the simple gaze, although Thomas will use the simple word intellect to name both. So we're talking about God's intellect, God's knowing power. And asking whether or not intellect or intelligence is a word we can apply to God, we think something like this. The words most likely to apply to God, the words most likely to name a pure perfection, one of those perfections that has no non-being or potency mixed into its very meaning, those words are likely to be the words that name the best perfections we know. And of everything we know, the preeminent seems to be intelligence. Now, you should package along with intelligence everything that goes with it, right? The intelligent creature is free, is capable of love, is capable of understanding, right? Everything that goes along with personhood is packed into the word intelligent. So since persons are the best things, it seems that we want to attribute this word to God. So this is a great one to try. We're going to have to test it to make sure that we can eliminate the potencies from it, the non-being out of it that may be incidentally attached, and make sure the word doesn't explode in the process of that purification. But this is a great candidate. That's the thrust of the first paragraph of chapter 28. The second paragraph is just arguing from the from the notion that freedom from matter is the cause of intellectuality. As I noted a minute ago, the way that forms that are potentially intelligible but are embedded in matter and therefore unavailable to the intellect, the way those things become actually intelligible is by being released from matter. So the peculiar way of knowing that the intellect has seems to be bound up with freedom from matter. So if you have something that is free from matter, it would seem to have that magic property, that property that makes for intelligence. So the implicit here is that you can have inert material substances, but you cannot have inert non-material substances. You cannot have non-personal spiritual substances. The moment you have a spiritual substance, you're going to be looking at an intelligence of some kind, right? So since God is pure act, has no potency or anything like matter in him, then he would be intelligent and presumably to a kind of maximal degree, since he has maximally the key condition for intelligence. All right, last paragraph of chapter 28 is again an appeal to sort of the superiority of intellect. We see that mind is the kind of thing that is essentially free. It is not moved by others, but moves others. And you know, we'll have to talk about how we relate to God's moving of us, right? That raises that's why that's a difficult conversation, because our entire instinct is that mind is what moves others. So when you look at the one who most of all moves others, that is the first mover, who is in no way moved by anything else, but himself moves all things, gives all things their direction, then that would seem to be intelligent. So again, we're looking at a great candidate for a word. We have every reason to believe that this property belongs to God. The only question is, can we clean the word up? Can we get rid of the sort of barnacle-like potencies and imperfections that have attached to our way of thinking of it due to the fact that we only encounter this perfection in creatures? So we move to chapter 29 and begin that process. And chapter 29 basically introduces the move, right? The move we've all been expecting. That is, we're going to say, but God has no potency, but is all act, right? And we get in chapter 29 an initial statement of what that premise is going to mean. So, for example, God can't be potentially knowing something and then later actually knowing something. He has to be, whatever he knows, he actually knows it all the time, right? So otherwise there would be potency in his understanding, and that's what we're trying to get rid of. So there's not going to be in God any kind of reasoning process. There's not going to be this step-to-step-to-step thing where he goes from premise to premise to premise, considers one idea, considers another idea, and so on. Whatever he understands all at once. Right? So, whereas we discern two different experiences within our knowing, that is, that we discern reason and intellect, you could call them. We discern the sort of step-to-step-to-step kind of reasoning power, and we also discern just the simple intuitive gaze on things. In God, we're only going to find the latter, only the simple intuitive gaze. So we do have that within us, and that's what we're going to have to focus on. When that gaze that just looks at, say, at the nature of man and just considers that without stepping through an argument, that simple gaze is what we have to have in mind for God. All right, so then we go to chapter 30, and we say, okay, let's start taking this idea that God's understanding is only an act, and let's break it down to the various kinds of potencies that might be there. So if we think about our mind, our mind knows by receiving a concept into it. And you will go through in philosophy sort of how that works. But our mind works by receiving knowledge, right? You get an idea. So we're going to have to say that this relationship of receiver to received, of mind to idea, is not present in God. Right, we're going to have to say that the God's intellect that knows and the knowledge he has are the same thing. So notice the move. When Thomas sees in a potency to act, a receiver to received relationship, the way he gets rid of the potency is by saying that what is normally receiver and received are in God identical. That way you have intellect, you also have knowledge, but you don't have a potency act relationship because the two are the same thing. So the move towards pure act is also the move towards simplicity. Now, God, this is a really important move when we say this, that God's very essence, which is in his intellect, God's very essence is that through which he knows. It is the idea he has in his mind, or it is the idea that is his mind. Language has a hard time keeping up with this, because this is very, very different from our experience, right? Imagine what would happen if your intellect were the same as the idea through which you know your intellect. Well, what would happen is you wouldn't have to do sophomore philosophy. You would simply have that knowledge, right? Isn't it funny that being yourself an intellect does not immediately give you the knowledge of the intellect? Even though intellect is wonderful in that it can curve back and think about itself, we can think about our thinking in a way that we can't see our own seeing, as we discussed in class before, the funny thing is it's not automatically already happening. Our immaterial intellects don't just know themselves by being immaterial intellects. We have to actually think. And then here's the weird part. We actually have to receive into our intellects an idea of our intellects, right? So we have this substance, the knower, and then we also have to have this accident in hearing in the substance, the idea of the knower. That's how we know ourselves, right? We have to kind of receive ourselves into ourselves in order to know ourselves. It's very strange if you think about it. Why do we not automatically know ourselves given that we are ourselves? Well, here it is. The reason is because in the normal operating procedure for us, our intellect is not identical with the concept through which it knows. And as a result, in order to know for the intellect to know itself, it has to get a concept of itself and receive that. So, back to God. Since God is identical with the concept through which he knows, he is identical with his own knowledge, then instead of intellect and idea, you simply have God's one essence. Here in this chapter, when St. Thomas says the word species, he means what we would mean by idea or concept. So you can track that lingo. Now, he immediately draws a fascinating consequence of this. That is that what God immediately, directly, primarily knows is himself, right? If you were trying to understand St. Thomas gives the example, if you're trying to understand something and you're understanding it through the definition of a horse, well, the first thing you're knowing is a horse. And then maybe through knowing a horse, you know other things. But given that what you're trying to know through is the essence of horse, then horse is what you're primarily knowing. Well, if what God knows through is his own essence, then he himself is what he primarily knows. And he would know, we'll have to talk about how he knows creatures later down the road, but however he knows them, he knows them in an indirect way through knowing his own essence. Now again, we've got to contrast this with ourselves. We are so strange and alienated from ourselves. We first of all know things around us. Then we notice that we're knowing things. We say we come to know our knowing. And then by reflecting on our knowing, we eventually conclude to the nature of our knowing power. So our intellects have to go by a very circuitous route, possibly starting with something like horse, and then noticing, oh wait, look at me, I'm knowing horse, how am I doing that? And then analyzing the universal, like the fact that I have universal knowing, to get back to the nature of immaterial intellect. That's a very strange thing. For God, it's much more straightforward. It's much more, in a way, intuitive. You would think that you yourself are better known to yourself than anything else. And with God, that's absolutely true. Because he knows everything through knowing himself. For us, we actually start by knowing other things and then move to the inside. So we are much weirder than God. God is normal. God knows everything else by knowing himself, by knowing what is closest to him. In fact, knowing what is identical with his knowing power, his own essence. This brings us to chapter 31. We've said so far that God's intellect is the same as the knowledge in his intellect. Now we're going to say that both of those are identical with his actual consideration of what he knows. That is to say, I might know nothing about Iceland. Then I read an encyclopedia and I learn a bunch of stuff about Iceland. Now I have knowledge of Iceland, but I stop thinking about it. And instead, I go and think about horses and about God's intellect and about theology for a long time. And then one day, I suddenly think about Iceland again, right? Then the knowledge that I had actually acquired, but I was not actually using, now I'm actually using, right? So you can go from sheer potency, where you don't have any knowledge of Iceland, to a kind of to first act, where you have knowledge of Iceland, but you're not using it, to second act, that is full act, where you not only have knowledge of Iceland, but you are not potentially using it, but actually using it. If we're going to get rid of all potency from God, we're going to have to get rid of that distinction too. So God is not only identical with his own intellect and identical with his own knowledge, he's also identical with his own act of knowing, his own actual consideration of what he knows, right? So again, note the key move that he's going to use through our next reading too. When you have a received to receiver, a potency to act relationship, the way Thomas will get rid of the potency is to say the two are identical, right? So we don't get rid of intellect or get rid of knowledge. We say they are identical. And here we say God doesn't have actual knowledge that he's only potentially using. All his actual knowledge is the knowledge he's actually considering, which of course is similar to what we said back in chapter 29. The last paragraph of this chapter is sort of a wonderful use of relationships. He says that the intellect is related to the act of understanding as essence is related to existence. So he's thinking of the intellect as sort of a potentiality that is realized, takes on a definite form when it is considering knowledge. So the our intellect is in this regard, kind of like immaterial prime matter, if that's not too mind-blowing a phrase. That is, our possible intellects, the term you'll learn in philosophy soon. We have the ability to become, in a way, all things. We can take all natures into ourselves, but we start off with none of that. And the intellect only is formed by the knowledge that it takes on in itself. So he says, that's why he says the intellect is related to its act of understanding, as essence is related to existence. You've got this specific kind of thing that only receives real existence when it takes on this definite form. Our potential knowledge is only real knowledge when we are definitely knowing something. So he gets this parallel. Intellect to active understanding is as essence to existence. But in God, intellect equals the essence, right? The first term in each of these proportions is the same, right? When we say intellect to active understanding and essence to existence, essence is the same thing as intellect, right? So then whatever is the relationship between essence and existence will be the relationship between intellect and active understanding. Well, we already know that essence for God equals existence. It's the same thing. So his intellect is the same thing as his active understanding. If that's a confusing argument, try doing it on paper. It gets a lot easier. Okay, and now for the punchline. We have walked through the steps. We have tested this word intelligent or intellect by trying to eliminate all the various potencies from it, and it doesn't explode, right? It's not like trying to take the word potato and eliminate all materiality from it, in which case your potato is gone. We started with intellect or intelligence. We eliminated all these potencies, and it's still here. We're still saying something. It worked. This word will fly. This word, we can get up there, it can achieve orbit velocity, and we can stick it onto God. And the steps we've gone through, just to review, are we've said that in God, the intellect, the intelligible species or concept, and the act of understanding or actual use of that concept are all the same reality. And those three are, in fact, the exact same thing as his essence. And so his God simplicity and his being as pure act is preserved. And along the way, we find out how weird is our own way of knowing, which is so alienated from itself. God's way of being intellect not only works, but to be honest, makes more sense than ours.